Chapter 9. Of their obliterated past, as a man who has mastered the spirit of a foreign tongue turns with renewed wonder to the pages his youth has plodded over. In this lucidity of retrospection, the most trivial detail had its significance, and the rapture of recovery was embittered to Glenard by the perception of all that he had missed. He had been pitiably, grotesquely stupid. And there was irony in the thought that, but for the crisis through which he was passing, he might have lived on in complacent ignorance of his loss. It was as though she had bought him with her blood. That evening he and Alixa dined alone. After dinner he followed her to the drawing room. He no longer felt the need of avoiding her. He was hardly conscious of her presence. After a few words they lapsed into silence, and he sat smoking with his eyes on the fire. It was not that he was unwilling to talk to her. He felt a curious desire to be as kind as possible, but he was always forgetting that she was there. Her full bright presence, through which the currents of life flowed so warmly, had grown as tenuous as a shadow, and he saw so far beyond her. Presently she rose and began to move about the room. She seemed to be looking for something, and he roused himself to ask what she wanted. Only the last number of the horoscope. I thought I'd left it on this table. He said nothing, and she went on. Colin, you haven't seen it? No, he returned coldly. The magazine was locked in his desk. His wife had moved to the mantelpiece. She stood facing him, and as he looked up he met her tentative gaze. Was reading an article in the Day Review of Mrs. Aubin's letters, she added, slowly, with her deep, deliberate blush. Glenard stooped to toss his cigar into the fire. He felt a savage wish that she would not speak the other woman's name. Nothing else seemed to matter. "Who seemed to do a lot of reading," he said. She still earnestly confronted him. "Was keeping this for you, I thought it might interest you," she said, with an air of gentle insistence. He stood up and turned away. He was sure she knew that he had taken the review, and he felt that he was beginning to hate her again. "I haven't time for such things," he said, indifferently. As he moved to the door he heard her take a precipitate step forward. Then she paused and sank without speaking into the chair from which he had risen. As Glenard, in the raw February sunlight, mounted the road to the cemetery, he felt the beatitude that comes with an abrupt cessation of physical pain. He had reached the point where self-analysis ceases. The impulse that moved him was purely intuitive. He did not even seek a reason for it, beyond the obvious one, that his desire to stand by Margaret Aubin's grave was prompted by no attempt at a sentimental reparation, but rather by the vague need to affirm in some way the reality of the tie between them. The ironical promiscuity of death had brought Mrs. Aubin back to share the narrow hospitality of her husband's last lodging, but though Glenard knew she had been buried near New York, he had never visited her grave. He was oppressed, as he now threaded the long avenues, by a chilling vision of her return. There was no family to follow her hearse. She had died alone, as she had lived, and the distinguished mourners who had formed the escort of the famous writer knew nothing of the woman they were committing to the grave. Glenard could not even remember at what season she had been buried, but his mood indulged the fancy that it must have been on some such day of harsh sunlight, the incisive February brightness that gives perspicuity without warmth. The white avenues stretched before him interminably, lined with stereotyped emblems of affliction, as though all the platitudes ever uttered had been turned to marble and set up over the unresisting dead. Here and there, no doubt, a frigid urn or an insipid angel imprisoned some fine-fibred grief, as the most hackneyed words may become the vehicle of rare meanings. But for the most part the endless alignment of monuments seemed to embody those easy generalizations about death that do not disturb the repose of the living. Glenard's eye, as he followed the way indicated to him, had instinctively sought some low mound with a quiet headstone. He had forgotten that the dead seldom planned their own houses, and with a pang he discovered the name he sought on the cyclopean base of a granite shaft rearing its aggressive height at the angle of two avenues. How she would have hated it, he murmured. A bench stood near, and he seated himself. The monument rose before him like some pretentious uninhabited dwelling. He could not believe that Margaret Aubin lay there. It was a Sunday morning, and black figures moved among the paths, placing flowers on the frost-bound hillocks. Glennard noticed that the neighboring graves had been thus newly dressed, and he fancied a blind stir of expectancy through the sod, as though the bare mound spread a parched surface to that commemorative rain. He rose presently, and walked back to the entrance of the cemetery. Several greenhouses stood near the gates, and turning in at the first he asked for some flowers. "Anything in the emblematic line?" asked the anemic man behind the dripping counter. Glennard shook his head. "Just cut flowers? This way, then." The florist unlocked a glass door, and led him down a moist green aisle. The hot air was choked with the scent of white azaleas, white lilies, white lilacs. All the flowers were white. They were like a prolongation, a mystical efflorescence, of the long rows of marble tombstones, and their perfume seemed to cover an odor of decay. The rich atmosphere made Glennard dizzy. As he leaned in the doorpost, waiting for the flowers, he had a penetrating sense of Margaret Aubin's nearness, not the imponderable presence of his inner vision, but a life that beat warm in his arms. The sharp air caught him as he stepped out into it again. He walked back, and scattered the flowers over the grave. The edges of the white petals shriveled like burnt paper in the cold, and as he watched them the illusion of her nearness faded, shrank back frozen. Zion, the motive of his visit to the cemetery remained undefined save as a final effort of escape from his wife's inexpressive acceptance of his shame. It seemed to him that, as long as he could keep himself alive to that shame, he would not wholly have succumbed to its consequences. His chief fear was that he should become the creature of his act. His wife's indifference degraded him. It seemed to put him on a level with his dishonor. Margaret Aubin would have abhorred the deed in proportion to her pity for the man. The sense of her potential pity drew him back to her. The one woman knew, but did not understand. The other, it sometimes seemed, understood without knowing. In its last disguise of retrospective remorse, his self-pity affected a desire for solitude and meditation. He lost himself in morbid musings, in futile visions of what life with Margaret Aubin might have been. There were moments when, in the strange dislocation of his view, the wrong he had done her seemed a tie between them. To indulge these emotions he fell into the habit, on Sunday afternoons, of solitary walks prolonged till after dusk. The days were lengthening, there was a touch of spring in the air, and his wanderings now usually led him to the park and its outlying regions. One Sunday, tired of aimless locomotion, he took a cab at the park gates, and let it carry him out to the Riverside Drive. It was a gray afternoon streaked with east wind. Glennard's cab advanced slowly, and as he leaned back, gazing with absent intentness at the deserted paths that wound under bare boughs between grass banks of premature vividness, his attention was arrested by two figures walking ahead of him. This couple, who had the path to themselves, moved at an uneven pace, as though adapting their gait to a conversation marked by meditative intervals. Now and then they paused, and in one of these pauses the lady, turning toward her companion, showed Glennard the outline of his wife's profile. The man was Flamel. The blood rushed to Glennard's forehead. He sat up with a jerk, and pushed back the lid in the roof of the hansom, but when the cabman bent down he dropped into his seat without speaking. Then, becoming conscious of the prolonged interrogation of the lifted lid, he called out, "Earn drive back anywhere, I'm in a hurry." As the cab swung round he caught a last glimpse of the two figures. They had not moved. Alexa, with bent head, stood listening. My God," he groaned. It was hideous, it was abominable, he could not understand it. The woman was nothing to him, less than nothing, yet the blood hummed in his ears and hung a cloud before him. He knew it was only the stirring of the primal instinct, that it had no more to do with his reasoning self than any reflex impulse of the body, but that merely lowered anguish to disgust. Yes, it was disgust. He felt almost a physical nausea. The poisonous fumes of life were in his lungs. He was sick, unutterably sick. He drove home and went to his room. They were giving a little dinner that night, and when he came down, the guests were arriving. He looked at his wife. Her beauty was extraordinary, but it seemed to him the beauty of a smooth sea along an unlit coast. She frightened him. He sat late that night in his study. He heard the parlor maid lock the front door. Then his wife went upstairs, and the lights were put out. His brain was like some great empty hall with an echo in it. One thought reverberated endlessly. At length he drew his chair to the table and began to write. He addressed an envelope and then slowly reread what he had written. "My dear Flamel, many apologies for not sending you sooner the enclosed check, which represents the customary percentage on the sale of the letters. Trusting you will excuse the oversight, ours truly, Tiffin Glennard." He let himself out of the darkened house and dropped the letter in the post box at the corner. The next afternoon he was detained late at his office, and as he was preparing to leave he heard someone asking for him in the outer room. He seated himself again, and Flamel was shown in. The two men, as Glennard pushed aside an obstructive chair, had a moment to measure each other. Then Flamel advanced, and drawing out his note case, laid a slip of paper on the desk. "My dear fellow, what on earth does this mean?" Glennard recognized his check. "That I was remiss, simply. It ought to have gone to you before." Flamel's tone had been that of unaffected surprise, but at this his accent changed and he asked, quickly, "On what ground?" Glennard had moved away from the desk and stood leaning against the calf-backed volumes of the bookcase. "And the ground, that you sold Mrs. Aubin's letters for me, and that I find the intermediary in such cases, is entitled to a percentage on the sale." Flamel paused before answering. "Who find, you say? It's a recent discovery?" "Obviously, from my not sending the check sooner. You see, I'm new to the business." "And since when have you discovered that there was any question of business, as far as I was concerned?" Glennard flushed and his voice rose slightly. "Are you reproaching me for not having remembered it sooner?" Flamel, who had spoken in the rapid repressed tone of a man on the verge of anger, stared a moment at this and then, in his natural voice, rejoined, good-humoredly, "Upon my soul, I don't understand you." The change of key seemed to disconcert Glennard. "'Tis simple enough," he muttered. "Simple enough you're offering me money in return for a friendly service? I don't know what your other friends expect. Some of my friends wouldn't have undertaken the job. Those who would have done so would probably have expected to be paid." He lifted his eyes to Flamel, and the two men looked at each other. Flamel had turned white and his lips stirred, but he held his temperate note. "If you mean to imply that the job was not a nice one, you lay yourself open to the retort that you proposed it. But for my part, I've never seen, I never shall see, any reason for not publishing the letters." "That's just it. What, the certainty of your not seeing was what made me go to you. When a man's got stolen goods to pawn, he doesn't take them to the police station." "Stolen?" Flamel echoed. "The letters were stolen?" Glennard burst into a coarse laugh. "How much longer do you expect me to keep up that pretense about the letters? You knew well enough they were written to me." Flamel looked at him in silence. "Here they?" he said at length. "I didn't know it. And didn't suspect it, I suppose," Glennard sneered. The other was again silent. Then he said, "I may remind you that, supposing I had felt any curiosity about the matter, I had no way of finding out that the letters were written to you. You never showed me the originals." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.